Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this next segment, we're going to continue a journalistic update of new developments in the investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy. In my personal opinion, the single most dramatic and probably the most important book to be written, or at least issued, in the aftermath of the movie JFK was Dick Russell's landmark book, The Man Who Knew Too Much, about former U.S. intelligence operative Richard Case Nagel, last name N-A-G-E-L-L. It's a huge book, and it not only covers Nagel's situation, but it covers a great many other aspects of the investigation into President Kennedy's assassination. That book was published in hardcover and softcover by Carolyn Graff, copyright 1992. And the author of that book, Dick Russell, last name R-U-S-S-E-L-L, is the author of a fascinating and very important article that appeared in High Times magazine, issue of March 1996. Research credit on this goes to a listener who sent this to me. In fact, a couple of different listeners sent this in, so research credit on this article goes to those listeners. Richard Case Nagel died under somewhat ambiguous circumstances shortly after the Assassination Records Review Board expressed interest in interviewing Nagel about his particular story. We are going to discuss the circumstances surrounding Richard Nagel's death, the even more important circumstances around his life, and the other information touched on by Dick Russell in this article entitled Oswald and the CIA, again from High Times magazine's issue of March of 1996. And again, I want to briefly restate at the beginning of this rereading or reading of this article, I personally do not believe that the CIA ordered President Kennedy's assassination. I do feel that there were some elements of the CIA involved in the assassination, but that in all likelihood they were responding to a different master. They were in all likelihood working for a different agency and fell well to the right of the CIA as a whole and were dissatisfied with the CIA as a whole because of its policies, which they felt were too liberal. And again, that might appear crazy to the uninitiated, but in particular in the extremely polarized Cold War years of the early 1960s, there were people within the national security establishment, and a great many of them, who viewed the CIA as too liberal. And in my opinion, those elements of the CIA that appear to have been involved in Kennedy's assassination were responding to one of their less liberal mentors. We're going to begin reading now Dick Russell's Oswald and the CIA from High Times of March of 1996. The introduction to the article reads as follows. During the last 2 years, many long-suppressed files on Lee Harvey Oswald have finally been released. Evidence continues to grow on Oswald's connections to the most powerful secret police force in the world, the Central Intelligence Agency. This by Dick Russell. By the way, as sort of a parenthetical element, as an aside, the CIA is certainly very important and extremely dangerous. It is, however, a relatively minor element of the U.S. intelligence apparatus. The CIA only gets 15% of the U.S. intelligence budget, and according to my studies, the NSA, the National Security Agency, and the Defense Intelligence Agency, among other agencies, are at least as powerful, if not more powerful, and I believe the latter two are more powerful than the CIA proper. One never hears about them, however, or outfits like the Office of Naval Intelligence, which is extremely powerful. One hears about the CIA. And again, although it is very powerful and in its own way quite sinister much of the time, the CIA is a relatively minor portion of our intelligence system, and that should be borne in mind. Proceeding with Dick Russell's Oswald and the CIA, at 9 p.m. last November 1st, that would, of course, been of 1995, the landlord of a house in the Echo Park section of Los Angeles unsuccessfully tried the locks, then pried open a window and forced his way inside. Joe Motyka, M-O-T-Y-K-A, had been alerted by a neighbor that his tenant, 65-year-old Richard Case Nagel, had not been seen for several days. Motyka discovered the already decomposing body of Nagel in the bathroom and immediately alerted the police. Only the morning before, in Washington, the Assassination Records Review Board, or ARRB, mandated by Congress under the JFK Records Act of 1992 to review for public release all still secret files on the John F. Kennedy assassination, had mailed Richard Nagel a letter. The board was seeking access to documentation he claimed to possess about a conspiracy to murder the 35th President of the United States. Although an autopsy performed by the L.A. County Coroner's Office determined that Nagel had died of a heart attack, the timing triggered alarm inside the ARRB. More than a month earlier, based upon testimony of this writer at a public hearing in Boston, ARRB executives had decided to pursue Nagel's private files and use their subpoena power to call him to testify. Upon hearing of his sudden death, the ARRB issued a subpoena for any records he may have kept in his house and flew an investigator to Los Angeles. What may surface next remains an open and very provocative question. As outlined in my 1992 book about Nagel, The Man Who Knew Too Much, Carolyn Graff Publishers, New York, the ex-military intelligence and CIA operative said he had made arrangements for certain, quote, smoking guns, unquote, to be divulged in the event of his death. These are likely to include a tape recording done surreptitiously by Nagel in the late summer of 1963, where at least four individuals, himself, Lee Harvey Oswald, and two Cuban exiles, plotted the assassination of President Kennedy. A photograph of Nagel and Oswald, which Nagel had a vendor take in New Orleans' Jackson Square, was said to be stashed in a bank vault in Zurich, Switzerland. In summary, what Nagel has chosen to reveal about his role in the conspiracy goes like this. Under contract to the CIA, he undertook an assignment as a, quote, double agent, unquote, who would cooperate with Soviet intelligence beginning in the autumn of 1962. Under KGB instructions from Mexico City, for a year he monitored discussions among a group of embittered Cuban exiles who were seeking to assassinate Kennedy and make it look as though Fidel Castro's Cuba was behind it. He was immediately asked to keep an eye on Lee Harvey Oswald, recently returned to America after his alleged, quote, defection, unquote, to the USSR. Oswald was brought into the conspiracy in July of 1963, deceived into thinking he was working for Castro. Soviet intelligence ordered Nagel either to convince Oswald he was being set up to take the rap, or to kill him in Mexico City before the assassination could transpire. While both U.S. and Soviet intelligence agencies were aware of the conspiracy, it was the KGB, not the CIA or FBI, that attempted to prevent it. The Soviets, who had reached a growing accommodation with Kennedy after the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, were also afraid that the assassination would be falsely blamed upon them or the Cubans. Nagel, instead of carrying out his assignment, sent a registered letter to the FBI, for which he also served as a confidential informant. Nagel, instead of carrying out his assignment, sent a registered letter to FBI, which he also served as a confidential informant, Director J. Edgar Hoover, more than 2 months before the tragedy in Dallas, providing enough information to warrant the arrest of Oswald and two Cuban exiles. While the Bureau says it cannot locate any such letter in its files, it is likely that Nagel kept a copy and the registered mail receipt among his effects. Also alerting CIA officials of the plot, Nagel then walked into a bank in El Paso, Texas on September 20th, 1963, fired two shots into the wall, and intentionally had himself placed in federal custody. He hinted to me in a series of meetings that right-wing extremists, including wealthy Texas oil interests and CIA renegades, were ultimately behind the assassination. Considerable documentation, including a notebook seized by the FBI upon Nagel's arrest that contained listings remarkably similar to Oswald's own notebook, already lends credibility to his story. Yet he was ignored by both the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee on Assassinations. The new ARRB thus became the first official government body to express an interest in what he might be able to reveal. And like Oswald's friend George de Morenshield, who allegedly committed suicide hours before a House Select Committee investigator was to see him in 1977, suddenly, Nagel was dead. Previously unavailable files released so far through the ARRB's process have already raised more questions about a high-level cover-up surrounding Nagel. After his arrest in El Paso, he was held without a trial for 9 months in a county jail, where the FBI and Secret Service visited him on several occasions after the assassination. Although no mention is made of Nagel in the Warren Commission's 26 volumes, FBI reports from December of 1963 clearly state that he talked of having known Oswald in Texas and Mexico City. Transcripts of assassination-related telephone conversations with President Lyndon Johnson show that his friend Homer Thornberry, T-H-O-R-N-B-E-R-R-Y, a federal judge who had been a Texas congressman, was in touch with LBJ twice in the weeks following the assassination. Then, late in January of 1964, Thornberry suddenly stepped in as the new judge in the Nagel case, where court transcripts indicated a concerted effort to suppress Nagel's efforts to describe his true motive for his alleged, quote, attempted bank robbery, unquote. Thornberry handed down the maximum sentence upon Nagel's conviction in June of 1964, a conviction that was later overturned on appeal. Nagel was released from prison in the spring of 1968. Flying to Europe shortly thereafter, where he was arrested on a train by East German authorities and held for 4 months behind the then, quote, Iron Curtain, unquote, before being released to U.S. authorities at the Berlin border. Long before this, according to a just-classified March 20, 1964 CIA file, the agency was pursuing the significance of six names of his CIA employees found in the Nagel notebook taken by the FBI in September of 1963. Another CIA memorandum, dated July 20, 1963, out of its Mexico City station, tells of an American using the name Eldon Henson, H-E-N-S-E-N, who wanted to establish contact with the Cuban embassy there. Having picked up the information via a telephone tap, the CIA then dispatched someone posing as a Cuban embassy officer to lure Henson to a hotel restaurant. The file describes Henson's expressed willingness to, quote, help Castro government in U.S., willing travel, has many good contacts in states, can move things from one place to another, unquote, which carries overtones of Nagel's own, quote, double, unquote, role. Author John Newman in Oswald and the CIA, his 1995 book based upon the recently released files, uses this incident to highlight the CIA's capability to, quote, enter surreptitiously into someone's life to control or manipulate it, unquote, a scenario Newman cites as a precursor to the agency's shenanigans when Oswald paid visits to the Soviet and Cuban embassies in Mexico City 2 months later. What Newman fails to mention in the significance of the CIA file stating that Henson, quote, agreed accept phone call with keyword Laredo as call from deleted contact, unquote. In one of my interviews with Nagel in 1978, he discussed his own use of the same code name Laredo when making contact with Soviet intelligence. When I last spoke with Nagel in April of 1994 and gave him Henson's physical description, he said only, quote, that fits somebody I'd run into at the time, unquote. Asked why he chose not to mention Nagel in his book, Newman responded, quote, my methodology made that impossible. If it wasn't in the new documents, it didn't make it into my manuscript. I wanted to keep everything focused on the CIA's internal paper trail. I still don't know what to make of the Nagel story. If it's true, it's dynamite, unquote. We're going to take a minute to review what we've looked at so far in the discussion of Richard Case Nagel. First of all, we began by taking a look at the discovery of Richard Nagel's body on November 1st of 1995. A fellow tenant had alerted his landlord that Nagel had not been seen for a number of days. The landlord then gained entrance to Nagel's apartment and discovered Nagel's already badly decomposing body. Only the morning before the discovery of Nagel's body, the Assassination Records Review Board had mailed Nagel a letter and was seeking access to documentation he claimed to possess about a conspiracy to murder Kennedy. Although an autopsy performed by the L.A. County coroner indicated that Nagel had died of a heart attack, I would not take that personally as definitive. There are any number of methodologies that have been developed not only by ours but other intelligence agencies to simulate natural death and to be undetectable afterward, including heart attack. So that is something that should not be viewed as definitive, in my opinion. That is to say, the coroner's ruling. Again, we should note that more than a month earlier, based upon testimony of Dick Russell at a public hearing in Boston, ARRB executives had decided to pursue Nagel's private files. Nagel then turned up dead under unexplained circumstances, one of a number of untimely deaths that have occurred in connection with the JFK assassination. We talked about the alleged suicide of William Pritzer in an earlier article. This may very well have been the death of Pritzer may very well have been an assassination. We've also taken note of the fact that there may very well be a number of, quote, evidentiary smoking guns, unquote, including a recording of Nigel and Oswald and two Cuban exiles, anti-Castro Cubans, talking about murdering Kennedy, a possible photograph of Nigel with Oswald in Jackson Square in New Orleans, and a number of other possible pieces of evidence that could confirm Nigel's story. We should note that Nigel maintains that he was ordered by the CIA to defect, quote unquote, to the Soviet Union, much as Lee Harvey Oswald appears to have been ordered by one or another U.S. intelligence agency, and that he was then assigned by the KGB to monitor Oswald and to monitor anti-Castro Cubans in a possible attempt to assassinate President Kennedy and make it appear as either the Soviets appear as though either the Soviets and or the Cubans had performed the assassination. Nigel goes on to point out, or Dick Russell goes on to point out, that Nigel had alerted both the FBI and CIA about the impending attempt on Kennedy's life. They did not do anything about it. The KGB attempted to do something about it because they had reached an accommodation with Kennedy about the Cuban Missile Crisis and a number of other things. Of course, the assassination went ahead as scheduled. Richard Nigel, in September of 1963, after alerting the FBI and CIA, neither of whom did anything, that is to say, after alerting them about the impending assassination, Nigel fired two bullets into the wall of a bank and got himself imprisoned for, quote, bank robbery, unquote. He then continued to attempt to spill the beans concerning what he knew about a plot to assassinate Kennedy, and in vain, it would appear. We should note that Nigel was sentenced to a number of years in prison, then subsequently released in the spring of 1968, and that the judge Homer Thornberry, who handled his case, was a former Texas congressman, a good buddy of LBJ's, and had apparently been in relatively close contact with LBJ during the course of Nigel's trial. We also took note of a fellow named Eldon Henson, who was monitored by the CIA and was supposedly attempting to work on behalf of Castro's Cuba, and we've seen notations about how useful he may have been. Also, the fact that the code word Laredo was used by some of the apparent CIA handlers who were handling Eldon Henson's case. We have also noted that Henson appears to fit the physical description of someone that Nigel says he was in contact with at the time. The next major segment of the Dick Russell article, Oswald and the CIA, again, this from High Times magazine of March of 1996, and research credit on this, again, goes to a couple of listeners, concerns John Newman's recent book, Oswald and the CIA. John Newman, by the way, the author of a previous excellent book about JFK's plans to pull the United States out of Vietnam. That was called JFK and Vietnam. Russell goes on to describe Newman's efforts. What Newman sets down about the CIA's, quote, paper trail does, in fact, add credence to Nigel's revelations. Here, for example, is the author's summary analysis of the 3 months preceding the assassination. Quote, the CIA was far more interested in Oswald than they ever admitted to publicly. At some time before the Kennedy assassination, the Cuban Affairs offices at the CIA developed a keen operational interest in him. Oswald's visit to Mexico City may have had some connection to the FBI or CIA. It appears that the Mexico City station wrapped its own operation around Oswald's consular visits there. Whether or not Oswald understood what was going on is less clear than the probability that something operational was happening in conjunction with his visit, unquote. Noting the possibility of a CIA, quote, renegade faction, unquote, manipulating Oswald, Newman concludes, again quoting, we can finally say with some authority that the CIA was spinning a web of deception about Oswald weeks before the president's murder, unquote, based upon an exhaustive survey of now visible files that were denied to previous official investigations. This dovetails with Nigel's earlier statements that the CIA's Cuban task force, then run by Desmond Fitzgerald, as well as the agency's Mexico City station, were deeply embroiled in the Oswald affair. It also backs up his claim that Oswald did not know who pulled his strings. Newman devotes considerable attention, too, to Jerry Patrick Hemming, whose CIA files bear curious parallels to Oswald's. A former Marine who filed reports to the agency, Hemming claimed to have met with Oswald near the Cuban consulate in Los Angeles early in 1959. Hemming's trail into the Cuban exile community seems to have been followed by two CIA employees in Los Angeles, Joseph Devanon, capital D-A, capital V-A-N-O-N, and Ernest Liebacher, L-I-E-B-A-C-H-E-R. Both of their names appear in the notebook seized from Nagel by the FBI in September of 1963 under the heading, quote, CIA, unquote. And again, both of these names were in Nagel's notebook, and apparently they were independently established as pursuing activities along the line of what Nagel claims he was pursuing. Continuing. Also pertinent is Newman's tracing of earlier CIA interest in Oswald from the moment the ex-Marine showed up at the American Embassy in Moscow trying to renounce his citizenship in October of 1959. Quote, I was particularly interested, Newman says, in trying to marshal evidence for Oswald having been a counterintelligence dangle. In other words, the CIA would have been using him to ferret out a, quote, mole, unquote, who was first thought to be in the U-2 program before the focus very quickly changed to their own Soviet Russia division. A mole is a hidden asset of the KGB, such as Aldrich Ames, observing the then top-secret U-2 spy plane program was part of Oswald's mission while a Marine in Japan. Newman observes that the, quote, most pronounced fingerprints, unquote, on Oswald emanated from the CIA's mole-hunting unit, CISIG, run by the late super spook James Jesus Angleton. The existence of Soviet moles inside the CIA was among Nagel's key points about the assassination. He indicated that John Paisley, who was in charge of a CIA unit overseeing Soviet electronics at the time Oswald was employed in a radio factory in Minsk and who died mysteriously in 1978, was one such mole. Nagel also hinted that his own case officer inside the Mexico City station had nefarious ties to Soviet intelligence, which he himself did not discover until the late summer of 1963. This is not to say that the Soviets were behind the assassination, a theory that Nagel adamantly repudiated, but rather that the CIA hierarchy's cover-up of its relations with Oswald related to its ultra-secret mole hunt. Norman Mailer, whose 1995 book Oswald's Tale offers fresh insights into Oswald's time in the USSR, conducted numerous interviews with ex-KGB agents there. After reading Newman's book, Mailer says, quote, I redid a little of my thinking on what the KGB told us. They were very consistent, which made me suspicious as it made me confident. They said over and over they were not interested in Oswald because they had better information on the U-2. Quote, what is he, some kind of exotic dangle, unquote, they wondered? Did the CIA send him over here as just someone who they, CIA, could observe what's done to him? So we don't do anything to him. We don't debrief him overtly. We don't want to tip our hand, unquote. And Mailer goes on to say, I accepted that when I got to know the KGB and how conservative they were, how terrified of making a mistake. The KGB is seen in America as a tremendous evil, adventurers. Yeah, they had a wing of 100 guys who were daredevils like the CIA, but generally the outfit was exceptionally conservative. But reading Newman, I began to think they were afraid that the CIA was after a mole who was telling the KGB about the U-2. This is something I didn't think of while we were over there. I wish we had. We didn't see all of the KGB files, no question. They didn't reveal a lot to us, saying they were protecting their sources. And there's no question we received an edited version of their files, unquote. Taking up residence for 3 months in Russia, Mailer was granted access to much information gathered by the KGB during Oswald's tenure in the USSR, which his book quotes at length, and proves that Soviet intelligence bugged Oswald's Minsk apartment and maintained constant surveillance of his activities. Mailer believes the KGB, quote, never would have used Oswald. They had too much petty stuff on him. Once you've seen a man losing arguments and being stupid with his wife, it's very hard to pick him to go out and kill a president. In fact, their first fear was that the assassination was a provocation by the United States to start a nuclear war. But I used to quiz the KGB very hard about whether they didn't keep up with Oswald when he came back to the USA. Finally, what they confessed was they didn't have the resources. It was very difficult because their every move here was being watched. Unquote. This, of course, does not take into account whether the KGB could have utilized an American double agent like Nagel to keep tabs on Oswald. So again, some recounting of a possible CIA interest in Oswald as a mole, as an what is known here as an intelligence dangle, in order to attempt to determine whether the KGB did in fact have a mole deep inside of U.S. intelligence that they were using to gather information about the U2 project. Recall that Oswald had been assigned to the U2 project while he'd been in the Marines and while he'd been stationed at Otsugi Naval Air Station in Japan. By the way, at the end of the next segment, we're going to be summing up what we've looked at in this particular article, plus playing a short segment of a cassette documentary tape concerning the Kennedy assassination. That's an excerpt from the aforementioned Guns of November program. Please note that these half-hour segments are not available from archives on audio. They are available from a different outfit entitled Spitfire. Their address is P.O. Box 1179, Box 1179, that is in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire, ALCALAME at ix.netcom.com. Once again, ALCALAME at ix.netcom.com. The address, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. By the way, a number of listeners have inquired about when I would be doing some writing. I'm in the process of starting my own political journal, and since this hopefully is something that I will be making money from, I can't discuss details on the air. However, those of you who are interested can contact the publication. It's called Other Means, derived from the famous quote from Prussian military theoretician Karl von Clausewitz, that war is the continuation of politics by other means. That is the name of the publication. Other Means can be contacted at P.O. Box 191710, P.O. Box 191710, that is in San Francisco, 94119-1710. Once again, Other Means, P.O. Box 191710, San Francisco, California, 94119-1710. Again, a political journal that I'm in the process of starting. You can also inquire about that via my email address. You can reach me at demory, D-E-M-O-R-Y, D-E-M-O-R-Y, at well.com. Once again, D-E-M-O-R-Y at well.com. Again, for information about Other Means. That concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.